You know that Machiavellian question, that old Machiavellian question, is it better to be feared or better to be loved? Well, Machiavelli deemed that it was better to be feared than to be loved, but he was posing that question on the part of the ruler, not on the part of the ruled. And the implications change significantly when you reverse that. The ruler would rather be feared by the people than be loved by the people because their fear keeps them in line. But when you are the people themselves, it's better to be loved by the ruler than to be feared by the ruler. Because when the ruler fears you, then he'll do everything in his power to keep you down. And your governments in the West, your government in America, your so-called democracies, they don't love you, but they do fear you. They fear you more than any external enemy. And they do everything they can possibly do to keep you in line, to keep you neutralized, because they fear you. And because they do not love you, they don't respect you, but they are afraid of you. Their disrespect is manifest every day. In fact, your government's disrespect for you constitutes the whole context of your life in America, in the West, but especially in America. They think so badly of you that they don't really even hide it anymore. And this is definitely true across the entire collective West. Europe doesn't care about Europeans. The UK doesn't care about the British. Canada doesn't care about Canadians, and America sure doesn't care about Americans. There isn't a single Western government that demonstrates that it cares one bit about their people, but every single one of those governments fears their people. And that's probably the only reason why things aren't worse for you already than they are. If they thought that they could get away with it, if they thought that they could get away with treating you with the same brutality and the same violence that they used against the people of the Global South, well, they would do it in a heartbeat. If they weren't afraid, then every mass shooting in America would be a police shooting. Every police shooting would be a massacre. I'm telling you, they would gas the homeless if they thought they could get away with it. It's not their morals that prevents them from doing that kind of thing. We know it's not their morals because they act that savagely everywhere else. Why, you think police brutality is a problem now in America? If they could, believe me, they would have drone strikes every day in so-called minority communities. We know that they would do that. Because that's what they do to all the other people around the world who look like you, so-called minorities in other countries. They have no moral opposition to mass killing. They have no moral opposition to wanton violence and brutal repression. That's what they do everywhere. And they would do it to you in a heartbeat if they could. If you don't think that that's true, then you're seriously deluding yourself, and you actually need to get ready for this. Because the conditions of colonized countries are going to materialize in the West in the not-too-distant future. Mark my words. Well, how are they going to do that if they fear you? Because listen, when they fear someone or fear something, they don't just sit around biting their fingernails. The powerful don't have the power that they have because they're complacent and because they're passive. That's one thing that you have to give them. You have to give to the ruling class. Credit where credit is due. The institutions of power. They're proactive when it comes to threats to their position. And they've been working, like I said, to address the threat that's posed by their populations, the threat that you pose. They haven't been just hiding their heads in the sand, hoping that the danger will pass. No, they have been actively, aggressively, and relentlessly doing everything necessary to neutralize you. And the more they neutralize you, the more viciously they can deal with you. The more sidelined and the more marginalized that the population becomes, the easier it will be to take the glove off of that iron fist. See, overseas, they get the iron fist directly, but back home, they put a glove on. They use nice, warm, expensive bottled water when they waterboard you in the West. They don't use ice-cold water from a hose like they do in the Global South. They use fancy mineral water to waterboard you. But that's going to change. Please understand me. This is what people in the West need to understand. Your system is parasitic. It's predatory, and they prey on whoever they can by any means they can. Neoliberal capitalist subjugation is a crime of opportunity, and America is the land of opportunity. That phrase is more true now than it ever has been, just not the way that you've always understood it. Your own system is going to prey upon you now. I mean, it always has to one degree or another, of course, but now it's going to ravage you just like it ravaged the Global South for all these years. Because global power dynamics and economic realities in the world have changed. You created a class of people and of institutions that surpass the state in their power. And whose interests now are not bound to the interests of your nation or to your national economy or to your people. That makes your nation, your country, your people just as eligible for subjugation as all the countries and all the nations and all the peoples that you colonized and subjugated in the Global South throughout history.
When you have a man-eating wolf on a leash, that just makes you the closest man to him. Back after World War II, the military-industrial complex was a major engine for the U.S. economy, as we all know. And because of that, the politics of the U.S. adhered to the interests of the MIC, and that manifested mostly through foreign policy. Fear-mongering, conflict instigation, conflict perpetuation, war after war, enemy after enemy, and of course the Cold War, which played out very hot throughout the global South. That's the America that most of us all know, the bully, the terrorist, the war-mongering profiteer. But the economy in the United States has mutated over the decades. Financialization, globalization, multinational corporations, the freedom of capital, the Citizens United decision, obviously the internet, digitization, automation, and so on. But financialization was maybe the most significant factor in the change. Like I said, after World War II, the U.S. built its economic dominance through war, the military-industrial complex, the MIC, the corporations that were building bombs, planes, weapons technology, and so on. That was at the center of the system. The government poured billions of dollars into defense contracts, and wars were fought to maintain the empire's control over global resources and global markets, and to keep tax dollars flowing into the private sector companies tied to the military-industrial complex. But over the past few decades, Wall Street figured out how to exploit something even more profitable than war: debt, speculation, and the manipulation of financial markets. So instead of investing in factories or manufacturing, America turned to a system of financialization, whereby money is not made by producing goods, but just by moving money around by itself. Banks, hedge funds, asset management firms like BlackRock and Vanguard found ways to generate trillions of dollars without any need for military spending or manufacturing or doing anything productive at all. You know how they say that paper money has no inherent value, or that it just denotes value. It has value assigned to it because everyone just agrees to pretend that it's worth something. Well, that's basically what companies are today, like a Tesla or what have you. Their actual production is not seriously connected to their assigned value by the market. In other words, a company is just a financial instrument now. The wealth is created by share values, not by production and not by sales. This is why you have drastic spikes in the wealth disparity, because billions and billions upon billions of dollars can be made by just a tick on the stock market of just a couple of points, without anyone making some new product or selling some new service. That's financialization. And this shift has reduced the military-industrial complex relevance to the American economy in a number of ways. Instead of pumping trillions into weapons and war, the wealth of the elite is now mostly tied up in stocks and bonds and financial instruments. Financial institutions generate massive profits through speculation, derivatives, and asset management. And then you have the fact that companies like BlackRock, companies like Vanguard, own shares in almost everything. Defense, tech, energy, you name it. They don't care if the profits come from bombs or from Bitcoin. This diversification means that the old war profiteers like Lockheed and Raytheon and so on have to compete for influence in Washington over policy. Now, does that mean that the military-industrial complex is dead? Of course not. It's still powerful, but its grip has loosened, and it's now in competition with the other faction of the OCGFC that has broader interests, and that's the richer and more powerful faction. The empire's tools have shifted to one degree or another from bullets to balance sheets. But importantly, what you have to understand is that Wall Street is not an institution of the state, like the Pentagon. Financialization disconnected the most profitable sectors of the national economy from the nation and made them anational. So while you can still refer to this as an empire, America is no longer the emperor. It's just another possession of the empire. So Trump's election was not aborted by the military-industrial complex rigging it in favor of Kamala Harris, who is a neocon, like Biden and the Democratic Party and the mainstream Republican Party. They're all neocons, all aligned with the military-industrial complex, historically. And there has been a battle of sorts between the military-industrial complex faction of the owners and controllers of global financialized capital and the global-oriented, BRICS-oriented faction of the OCGFC. That's been going on for at least a decade, but very noticeably over the course of the last two administrations. The fact that the MIC did not mobilize rigging on behalf of Kamala Harris indicates that they understand that they can't go head-to-head with the a-national OCGFC anymore. That's probably an easier way to put it. You have a nationalistic OCGFC and an a-national OCGFC. The irony is that Trump is a nationalist in his rhetoric, but a-national in his interests and his loyalties and his agenda. Because again, ironically, It's in the interests of a national private sector power for governments to be nationalistic. And that's especially the case for the U.S., insofar as that nationalism manifests in isolationism and protectionism, because that involves reducing America's global presence and America's global interference. Remember that Trump is a mascot of that faction of the OCGFC, and that faction wants de-escalation in the Middle East, they want stability and so on. They want America withdrawn, and a new global order established, centered on the Global South, on BRICS, etc. They're not particularly interested in Europe surviving except as a dependency of the U.S. It's kind of a consolation prize to American empire. So the U.S. is likely going to undergo its own neoliberal prescription and will stumble towards recreating manufacturing capacity over the next few years, while the A-national OCGFC will make a kind of a capitalist hijra to the new realms of the global economy. So what does that mean for you? What does that mean for the average American? Well, what the military-industrial complex used to do to us in the global South, they're going to start doing to you, in America, in Europe. Yes, there will be increased militarization of the security forces in your countries, increased repression, increased violence, increased control. I said that they don't love you, they don't respect you, and in fact they have contempt for you, but they fear you. And they've been working on how to mitigate that fear, mitigate that threat that you pose. And at least one very obvious way that they can do that is to make you fear and hate each other. Making you hate and fear each other will become even easier over time, the more desperate your conditions and your circumstances become. So in many ways, this is just going to be a revival of Western so-called civilization's origin story. In the cold, barren, inhospitable plains and mountains of Europe, individuals and clans had to eke out their survival, and they developed predatory habits amidst the wolves and bears and what have you, and the other rival clans and so on. This is the origin of both materialism and individualism in the Western ethos. The battle for resources in a dog-eat-dog endless and relentless and ruthless struggle. So as things get more desperate in the West, you're just going to intensify in those instincts. Now partly, this is exactly what those in power have feared about you. So their main strategy is distraction, it's smoke screens, deflection, confusion, to make sure that you never target them with those survival instincts. Because things are going to get more desperate in the West, in America, and in Europe. Probably more so in Europe than America, but even in America, things are going to get harder. And I think they're going to get much harder. I've said before that you really need to start thinking of yourselves and seeing yourselves the same way that the power structure sees you. And by that I mean see yourselves as no different from the people of the Global South. Because the power structure sees you the same way. You think you're different. You think you're special. And that all the wars and the subjugation that America and the West have inflicted on the Global South all these years has been for your benefit. You're a slave in Pharaoh's palace, but you think you're a member of the family. You're not. They don't see you any differently than they see the other people whom they dehumanize in Africa, in the Middle East, in so-called Latin America, and in Asia. Especially if you're a so-called minority, if you're a member of the global majority living in America, living in the West, they don't see you any differently than they see all of the other non-white, non-Western global majority members whom they dehumanize and subjugate. And that's especially true for Muslims in the West. They don't see you as more human than the Palestinians that they're slaughtering, as the Iraqis, the Afghanis, the Somalis, the Syrians, the Libyans, the Lebanese. You think that on this side of the border you're a human, and on that side of the border you're a subhuman in their eyes? No. It's like the difference between an indoor voice and an outdoor voice. They haven't been less violent to you in America and in the West because being there makes them respect you. They've been less violent to you in America and in the West because they have an interest in maintaining a certain decorum at home. It's not about you. But maintaining that decorum is going to be less and less important in the next few decades. So I think that you're going to need again, to do the same thing that the OCGFC are doing, which is to look south and to look east for allies and partners and working relationships. We're going through a major transition, and it's going to be rocky. It's going to be treacherous. It's a dangerous and a risky transition in many ways. There's many parts, and all the parts are moving. All of it is fluid. It's constantly shifting. We know in the Global South, in the Muslim world, that the OCGFC are predators. We know that they are imperialists, and we know why they're coming. Why they're smiling, why they're shaking hands, and so on. We know that they don't want our regions to be stable for our benefit. We know that they don't believe in our stability and our security. They just want it for their own sakes. And we know that they can turn vicious at any moment. The deals and the partnerships that are being made, for instance, between the Khalij and BlackRock, it's similar to the deals that were made between Nur ad-Din al-Zengi and the Eastern Roman Empire. during the Crusades. Now as then, our lands are in precarious times. There are perilous deals and alliances being made between the private sector ruling class and the state ruling class of the Muslim world and the global south. But we're not making deals and alliances between ourselves at our level, at the common man level, at the grassroots level, and we need to. That'd be better for both of us, better for the global majority who live outside the West, and better for the global majority who are categorized in the West as minorities. You need to stop thinking in their terms. You need to stop categorizing in their terms. If you still have mental, cultural, and identitarian borders in your head that were taught to you by those in power, and you're unable to connect with your brothers and sisters in the rest of the world, then I think that your condition is going to be miserable moving forward. You know, Rasulullah ﷺ told a man one time, become Muslim. The man said, I'm not convinced by Islam. Rasulullah ﷺ said, become Muslim anyway. Certainty will come later. And I think that that's the best advice anyone can give you. Become Muslim and connect with the global ummah. We're 86% larger as a population than all of the non-Muslims in America and Europe combined. And we're everywhere in the world. Our countries have the most important resources. Our people are the youngest. Our people are the most cohesive, the most disciplined, the most communal global population on earth. So if you're a diaspora Muslim in the West, you need to connect with your people in the Muslim world. And if you're a so-called minority in the West who's a non-Muslim, then become Muslim, or at least ally with the Muslims. And I mean ally according to what that word really means. Because it doesn't mean infiltrate, and it doesn't mean transactional solidarity. It means real alliance towards mutually acceptable goals. You know how these liberals are in the West. They want a kind of unbalanced reciprocation whenever they ally, so-called, with the Muslims on this or that cause. We don't want that. We don't want you scratch my back and I scratch your private parts. That's the way they usually do it. No. Have enough sense to know that your so-called civilization, your so-called culture, your society, including all your theories and your philosophies, have only led to miserable and often gruesome conditions. And there's no answer and there's no remedy for you in anything that the West has produced in terms of a solution. I don't believe in communism and I don't believe in capitalism. I don't believe in socialism or Marxism or neoliberalism or patriotism or nationalism. I don't believe in libertarianism. I don't believe in any form of utopianism or any other ism that came out of the West. I believe in realism, plain and simple. I don't believe in your left and your right. And Muslims have no need whatsoever to get involved in any disputes or arguments between any of these partisan and theoretical Western factions. You know, in prison, because you're in a very restricted environment, you have to cope with people who you would never interact with outside. And very abnormal things become normalized. You become friendly with drug dealers, with smugglers, with traffickers, with thieves, with rapists, murderers, and everything. And of course, it's degrading intellectually. It's degrading morally. You have to take people seriously and listen to them, even when you know that they've done monstrous things. People that you would never deal with in the outside world. Well, honestly, the West has put the whole world in a similar position. You've done monstrous things, but everyone still has to take you seriously and listen to you and deal with you like you're normal, deal with you like you're reasonable, and treat you like you're in some kind of a position to talk about moral and political philosophies and theories. It's like listening to Ted Bundy or Jeffrey Dahmer's opinion on how to address income inequality. No, you're not qualified to talk. You have done and are doing horrific, evil things. There isn't a single word that you can say about how to solve a problem when you're the problem. As far as I'm concerned, your left and your right are just the two legs of the same blind man wandering in the dark over a cliff. And I think it's past time for the Western victims of Western so-called civilization to recognize this and start looking to genuine civilizations for ideas and for solutions and for comrades. Because you're in the belly of the beast. And the beast is bulimic.